This is the KOTO Community Radio News for Thursday, March 28th. I'm Gavin McGough.
And I'm Julia Caulfield.
In today's headlines, clouds remain for County Solar Code.
As her term winds down, County Poet looks ahead.
A crash course in Telluride housing projects.
And a mountain weather forecast.
Attendance of San Miguel County's work session on solar regulations was standing room only out at the Norwood Sheriff's Annex earlier this week. The crowd jostled to settle in for what would be a 4.5-hour meeting on the regulations with members from both the Board of County Commissioners and the Planning Commission in attendance. The effort to draft solar regulations for the county has stretched on for almost a year now, and was set off by a 600-acre solar project which was proposed by private developers outside of Norwood back in the spring of 2023. This latest draft of the regulations was released last week, and they followed a blockbuster meeting in late January when the county commissioners and planning commissioners discussed a first draft. In the last couple months, planning staff and consultants have considered feedback and drafted updates. Here's Planning Director Kay Simonson.
One of the things that had been asked was if we could consider reducing the threshold between large and medium. We had had 20 acres. So within this, we are suggesting reducing the threshold is for large-scale being ground-mounted solar arrays occupied by 10 acres or more.
Thus, in this latest draft, a greater number of projects would be considered large-scale, a designation which comes with increased scrutiny. The bulk of the concern amongst the public and amongst commissioners is the question of solar on Wright's Mesa.
And I know that in the last work session, it was suggested that we remove Wright's Mesa from large-scale. But just keep in mind that, you know, we weren't disregarding you, but we wanted to discuss some things before we made went to the final draft.
Conversation turned to those considerations. One issue is all the federal land on Wright's Mesa. Consultant Tori Jarvis says when it comes to that land, the county has limited powers.
What you can't do is say what uses can or can't occur on federal land. That's for the federal agencies to determine. So if your regulations say, no, you can't have solar here, then on federal land, that would be not allowed. And so the federal process would continue.
And the feds could potentially develop an industrial scale project. However, if the county did have regulations for solar in place, the feds would have to respond to those regulations and bring any of their projects before the county to make sure it fits county rules. In this sense, a strict code on what sort of solar is allowed could offer more protection than a simple ban, which would be meaningless to federal agencies. Simonson adds,
we would also like to note the potential areas for large-scale solar elsewhere in the county are limited. It's not saying that we're going to put that all of any large scale should all be in Wright's Mesa. It's just a, you know, reality.
It would be difficult, she notes, for the county to meet its renewable energy goals without considering Wright's Mesa for development. Hours of public comment at the meeting show the community remains fearful of development. Planning Commissioner Jocelyn Lifton-Zolin hears those worries and wants to respond in kind.
I think especially for Wright's Mesa, I want people to know that there is a limit to what we would actually consider. I just don't know that we have to have it so open-ended that people feel really nervous all the time.
County staff and consultants reiterate the best practice is to allow developers to apply, but make sure the rules are restrictive. Require applicants to prove they'll spare precious view sheds, retain trees, use water responsibly, avoid cherished agricultural lands, and so on and so forth. But, says Commissioner Ann Brown, some negative impacts from industrial-scale development cannot be undone. One is the community's attachment to the land and its agricultural history.
Our heritage within the community, how do you mitigate for that? And the other thing is the impact on the psyche of the community, which we are already experiencing. And I just, by allowing large scale on Wrights Mesa, it's impossible to mitigate those three impacts. How do we work with that?
Actually, says consultant Jarvis, the county can make developers mitigate for those things and require them to preserve the heritage of the Mesa if they want to put solar there.
That's a very high bar that you're putting before the applicant, but you are giving them the opportunity to show you and see what's possible if they even decide they want to apply. And that just as a general rule is our approach to drafting, is like, let the applicant come to you in a case-by-case basis and tell you how they may or may not do that. And you say no to the exact application if they don't meet that burden, as opposed to zoning it out.
Her point, in other words, is the county shouldn't say no. Instead, it should say yes if you meet these conditions. Determining how strict those conditions are remains the task as the county moves these draft regulations forward. As a next step, the two commissions appoint a subcommittee to take a deeper look at public comment, legal advice, and staff and consultant input. That subcommittee is composed of County Commissioner Ann Brown and Planning Commissioners Galena Gleason and Jocelyn Lifton-Zolene. Joanna Yonder has one more year in her term as San Miguel County's Poet Laureate, but she's got some plans for the position before she goes. Yonder stopped by KOTO this week to talk about her final year as the public bard. But first, she shared two poems. One, she said, was inspired by the recent passing of a cherished community elder.
These things land really heavily in our community, and I just wanted to make space for that, as well as for the fact that I know a ton of people are feeling the swelling of spring. In so many ways, poetry can be a vehicle for all kinds of emotion. So I have a poem about loss and just a little poem about kind of what's to come. Hearts go on, they say, and it is true that we're still here, lifeblood moving through our bodies, one day and one long inhale at a time. We miss you, and the sky some days feels like an unfair blue because you are not here to see it. All our lives are fleeting as a season. What spans wider than our earthbound sojourn? Just the bonds we share. When one of our own leaves us, we will still, forever, have the impulse that you're here, right at our side. And we will always, always have the notion still to turn to you and point towards the dawn. Look at that, our souls say to each other. Look at that. And this is called Flight. It's dedicated to my dear friend Bria. This morning, hummingbirds are gathering cobwebs and lichens, a sure sign that they are soon to nest. New chapters sometimes start with building, sometimes with destruction. In this case, the nestlings will emerge sometime out yet, but their mother has a thing or two to teach us. First, that newness comes from unexpected places, often smaller than imagined. Secondly, that even though it may take time, flight is both a birthright and a miracle. Think of this as you are lifting off. Think of what is burgeoning, the beautiful and boundless thing that is about to hatch.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Gavin. I appreciate you.
While Yonder was at CODO, she also discussed her ambitions to create an endowment fund for the Poet Laureate position going forward. For the first time ever, our laureate could be supported by a modest stipend. Here's Yonder.
You know, this position was opened up through the county in 2008, so it's been around for quite some time, and it has evolved quite a bit since it first began. And I think it's very important to note two things. One, you know, it's 2024 and we're not paying artists in exposure anymore. And number two, when you expect people to do work for free, or even when you offer them the gift of volunteering for free, that work then by nature is only available to the people who have the privilege of time to give to it. And I believe in building frameworks that invite people who haven't traditionally had time free necessarily, people who could free up more time if they were paid to do it, you know? So my hope is to seek funding for this position, and not for me, but for whoever's next, for the next poet laureate. So whoever you are out there, hopefully you're listening, and hopefully you know that this is going to be a paid thing and it's not lavish, but it's something to say. We legitimize your art by paying it. And also we invite you to create this art and see that we can, you can make space in your life for it.
You have done some sort of research into other poet laureate positions around the country as part of this process. What did you find out, and what did you find out about kind of our position in San Miguel County?
Well, I learned that San Miguel County is one of the first county poet laureateships in Colorado, which is very cool. Here we are, small but mighty. Way to go, San Miguel County. And I also learned that it's a very different place to place how this works. But in general, poets are funded for their time. And in general, the like 2 to 3 year span is how it works. There are some really beautiful ones, like the new Durango Poet Laureateship involves what they are calling a rising poet laureate. So it builds in some mentorship, which I would love to see happen in this as well.
You say it's been an incredibly positive experience, which, of course, to be kind of a public poet and have that title.
Yes.
Do you have speculations about what it will be like to be a poet that does not have that distinct honor and duty and calling?
I think it will change, because perhaps I will have a little more space to dedicate to my own poetry projects, opening up that space creatively to move into my own projects sounds really cool. And I also know I'll miss it in some ways. It's really been such a special experience.
That was San Miguel County Poet Laureate Joanna Yonder sharing a pair of poems and her reflections on a final year in the position.
Silverjack, Longwill, Sunnyside, Voodoo, Canyonlands, Tower House, updates to Shandoka. It can be tough to keep all of Telluride's housing projects in line, even for elected officials. Last week, Telluride Town Council and staff came together in a conference room at the Public Works Building for a rundown on housing projects in Telluride and how the town makes moves when it comes to what development to tackle next. Telluride Program Director Lance McDonald starts with an overview of the affordable housing landscape in the region. He says currently approximately 40% of deed-restricted housing in the county is owner-occupied, with 60% rentals.
We have a pretty good mix regionally. Geographically, it's a little bit, you know, the towns tend to weigh more heavily towards rental, and the county tends to go more towards for sale.
McDonald notes Mountain Village has approximately 80% of their deed-restricted units as rental, compared to 20% for sale. The nearly exact inverse is true for San Miguel County land, with 80% for sale and 20% for rent. Telluride sits roughly at the overall county average, with a 60-40 split between rental and owner-occupied.
You know, there is no magic ratio for resort communities, and what happens over the years is we were asked to do a lot of for sale housing, because 93% of the deed restricted housing in town in 2000 was rental. And so since 2000, we've focused a lot on for sale, Gold Run, Entrada, Longwood, you know. And then recently we've been asked by the business community and council and everyone to say, focus back on rental. So that's why you're seeing Sunnyside, Virginia Placer, you know, the Canyonlands project.
In order for the town to determine potential sites for housing, it uses a matrix, a tool to rate land as to its suitability for housing. The matrix calls out things like net gain in number of people, how many individuals can be housed on the property. The more people, the higher the value. Sustainability for a range of targeted unit types.
So that would mean, can it do single family, condo, apartment, and tiny homes, for example? That scores really high if you can do all those different types. And if the site's only really good for one type of housing, then it scores lower.
The matrix also asks about potential for other uses on the land, quality of development or livability, location, estimated cost of construction. A parcel of land will score higher if it helps disperse housing.
We have a lot of our deed-restricted housing in the west and the east ends, and we've been trying to repopulate the middle of town, Spruce House, Voodoo, projects like that.
Based on the matrix, town staff created a list of land that could potentially be a housing site. The list includes town-owned property, potentially available property, property not currently available for construction or sale. The list includes the Shandoka parking lot, Virginia Plaza, Voodoo, the site where Longwell sits.
One thing you'll see that's not on the list was Tower House, but the opportunity came up to purchase the property. So this was used as an evaluative tool. It wasn't like a to-do list. It wasn't a priority list or anything like that. It was a way to plug in property and see where it shook out relative to some other property.
With that said, community housing manager James Van Hooser notes they have ticked off a lot of property off the list.
The top four score criteria scoring town-owned sites, funny enough, all have various plans for housing on them in various stages.
The town of Telluride is currently working on six major projects. The Voodoo Project, a 27-unit rental development with commercial space, is due to be completed in the fall. The town is also working on an upgrade to Shandoka F building. Virginia Plaza Phase 2A and B will be a collective 19 to 21 units over two buildings. Phase A has been approved by the Historic and Architectural Review Commission. Phase B has a conceptual design. Canyonlands and Tower House by Clark's are both under the HARC review process. Finally, the town of Telluride is currently working with the Telluride Ski and Golf Resort to vision what development at Carhenge and the base of Chair 7 could look like.
It's always tricky to synchronize your schedule and make it to every salient town happening. But definitely make sure it's synced up so you are free to view the first ever Telluride World Synchronized Skiing Championship. A new event being put on by the Telluride Synchronized Ski Team, the championship is taking place this week with a grand finale on Friday the 29th at Competition Hill near Lift 4 on the ski resort. Spectators are welcome to come view a day of demonstrations and competition among synchro ski teams from both Telluride and the broader region. Synchronized skiing works like a dance, as teams of 4 to 8 athletes perform a choreographed routine in their descent down the slope, oftentimes set to music. A relatively new sport, it's gained traction in the ski community in recent years, with other championship events and synchro ski teams popping up around the West and internationally. Competition on the 29th kicks off at 10 a.m. with a break for lunch at Garano's before resuming at 1.
Jill Berkey's poetry is warm, complex, and intensely satisfying. Berkey grew up on a 3-generation cattle ranch in Nebraska and started her education in a 1-room schoolhouse. She has won the Mark Fisher Poetry Prize and appeared in Deep Wild Journal, Front Range Review, Paddlefish Pilgrimage, Plain Songs, and Soundings Review. Next week, she will be the featured poet for the Talking Gourds Bardic Trails Poetry Night, a collaboration with the Wilkinson Public Library and the Telluride Institute. At the event, Berkey will read some of her own work with time for questions about her influences and inspirations. There will also be time for participants to share poetry of their own. For those who desire, April's poetic prompt is Rebirth. The Talking Gourds Bardic Trail Poetry Night will take place on Tuesday, April 2nd at 7 p.m. via Zoom. Registration is available at TellurideLibrary.org.
State lawmakers hope to start voting this week on next year's budget. A legislative panel approved the spending plan last week. The so-called long bill totals about $40.5 billion. That's $3 billion less than Governor Jared Polis's fall budget proposal and over $4 billion more than last year's budget. One focus this year is workforce shortages. The spending plan includes large investments in state employees, healthcare workers, and public schools. Lawmakers scrambled to balance the budget last week after this month's lower-than-expected state revenue forecast.
Many Jackson, Wyoming residents from a specific mountainous region in Mexico will soon be able to get more support with passports, visas, birth certificates, and other documents. A new immigration office is slated to open in Jackson next month, specifically to help people from the Mexican state of Tlaxcala. But as Jackson Hole Community Radio's Hannah Merzbach reports for Rocky Mountain Community Radio, it hasn't been easy to set up shop in one of the most expensive places in the nation.
The Immigrant Resource Center was originally planned to open in Jackson over a year ago, but officials from the Mexican government couldn't find an office space.
We already have an office in Manhattan, and it was a little bit more expensive in Jackson than the one of Manhattan.
Paula Zabalsa, the director of the Immigrant Assistance Office in Tlaxcala, says while looking for a space in Jackson, her staff was able to open another one in Southern California, which she says was also much cheaper. But now Jackson could soon be home to the third office in the U.S. Zabalsa is looking at two rental options in the heart of town, thanks in part to help from other organizations in Jackson serving the Latino population.
It feels great to be surrounded by many people that are interested in welfare. We would like to work with them and to make life better for our paisanos.
She says she wants Tlaxcaltecans to feel supported by their home country's government. The goal is to open the office on April 24th, with the governor of the Mexican state traveling to Jackson to host the celebration. For KHOL News, I'm Hannah Merzbach.
On Thursday, members of the Boulder-based MODIS theater troupe performed for lawmakers at the state capitol. The work is part of the Transformative Stories Project, which shares the personal stories of transgender and non-binary people. For Rocky Mountain Community Radio, KGNU's Sam Fuqua spoke with Christian Solano Cordova with MODIS about why these stories need to be told.
People are just feeling very afraid right now and very raw. Last year and this year, we have a historic number of anti-trans and non-binary legislation across the country, and it's a huge uptick from prior years. And it's not, the problem isn't just the legislation, right? It's the rhetoric that accompanies it that really enables people to dehumanize transgender and non-binary folks. And all these kind of conspiracy theories around trans people and, you know, their motivations for wanting to live a genuine life, you know, that impact so many, you know, it kind of dissipates in our culture. And, you know, unfortunately, a lot of trans and non-binary people bear the brunt of that rhetoric. And oftentimes it does lead to violence. You know, I'm really thankful here in Colorado. I think we were kind of a refuge for a lot of folks, especially a lot of states around Colorado are starting to enact some anti-trans legislation. And so a lot of families are moving into Colorado seeking, you know, freedom, really, freedom for their kids and themselves to be able to be who they truly are.
I know that in years past, some Republicans in the Colorado General Assembly have introduced bills on things like what is called gender-affirming care and other aspects of target the transgender and non-binary communities. I'm not aware of any legislation introduced this session. Are you?
Thankfully, no. You know, last year there was a bill that would ban transgender athletes from competing, but it was thankfully, you know, killed in the legislature. So, you know, that bill we don't have to worry about, but there are some attempts at ballot measures in the, you know, the November election. And as far as I know, there's several kind of committees gathering signatures as we speak to try to get that placed on the ballot.
Now, you're bringing a performance to the state capitol, so this is pretty unique in my experience. The state capitol, while the legislature is in session, Modus Theater's transformative stories. Tell us about that.
We're bringing these amazing trans and non-binary monologuists to the capitol, thanks to, you know, our lovely host, Representative Brianna Titone, of course, Colorado's first transgender legislator. We're really excited to have legislators and community alike listen to these stories. And, you know, they're all about, you know, finding one's true self. They're about finding your own humanity and being your own best friend. They're about, of course, the challenges that trans people face, both oppression, but also finding liberation within yourself and in community.
Can you tell us about any of the monologues specifically?
We're only able to bring two really amazing stories to the Capitol. So, you know, the first one is Dr. Morgan Henry Seamont, who is the director of the Pride Office at CU Boulder. And his story is entitled Catch. He reflects on the overwhelming pain he experienced growing up in a small town without gender-affirming care and encourages us to support trans youth so they don't suffer the way that he suffered. That really hits it to the point, and hopefully it drives the point home to the legislature so they understand why these policies are really so harmful. And of course, I'm sure they hear from community all the time, right? But putting it in this autobiographical monologue format that Modus is so great at putting in front of audiences who need to hear it will hopefully go a long way. And another monologuist, Ruby Lopez, and her story is called Surprise, It's a Girl. Considering taking her own life at age 22, Ruby, with the support of her community, transforms a potential death story into a birth story and comes to love the beautiful woman that she is. There's some pain in these stories, but there's also a lot of love, a lot of self-discovery and self-empowerment.
Christian Solano Cordova, Communications Director with Modus Theater, thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
The National Weather Service forecast for the Western San Juans calls for a 40% chance of snow showers tonight with mostly cloudy skies and a low around 30 degrees. Friday, there's a chance of rain and snow showers with a high near 40. Friday night should be mostly cloudy with a low in the mid-20s. Winds could gust as high as 30 miles per hour. Saturday, expect partly sunny skies during the day and mostly cloudy skies at night. The high is around 40 degrees with a low around 30. There is a chance of rain and snow showers. This has been the news for Thursday, March 28th. Thanks for listening. If you have a story idea or a news tip, call the news team at 970-728-3206.
We would like to thank everyone who donated to CODO during our winter fun drive. A huge thank you to
Sarah Cully,
Heather and Dan Curtis,
Lori Dabson,
Aaron Dace,
Sebastian Dulluck,
Ember Edwards,
Mundy Erickson,
Devin Wilson,
Kevin Wilder,
Augusta Vatter,
Angela Mallard,
Patrick Ledwith,
Robert Peter,
Carrie DiStefano,
Abby Collins,
Jessica Newins,
Jason Arend,
Tommy Wintz,
Douglas and Sandy McLaughlin,
Susie Mead,
Hillary and Max Cooper,
Deb Dion,
Jessica Landon,
Ian Kirkwood,
Angela Hazelsward,
Will Downing,
David and Nancy Platt,
Franz Rossman,
Bert Rego,
Eric Reinhardt,
Scott Robson,
Sandy Scott,
Geneva and Laura Shawnette,
Matt Sheehan,
Kevin Kimbrough,
and Robin Cantor.
Thank you all so much.